shall we?
What's up? That smells so good.
So welcome back to Salazar's. Glad you guys are home and well. We got a quick report from... come on, names. Nope. Campus pastor, Steve Garvey. Come on. Good looking. Josh.
Josh. Holly.
Yeah, he gave us a quick rundown of the trip, so... I'm sure you guys, this is the danger of like showing up on Thursday when they've been here since Monday. You guys already covered all this with Bride, and I don't know what's happened or not happened. So,
cheers and joy.
Yeah, so anyway, welcome back. Glad you guys are here and good, so healthy and traveling overseas. It's always like,
yeah, no issue.
Am I gonna throw up? Am I not gonna throw up? Oh man. None of those issues. We were, Shay and I and Brad went to Thailand together in 1997, and all of us got various grades of sick, and I was the worst. I got pretty sick. Like, yeah, I just asked God to kill me. I'm like, can we? I'm really done.
Serious joke.
With no proper facilities, like you're just sick, and it's starting not to be graphic at 6 a.m. But here we go. Anyway, Shay's been super sick. You should ask him some of his stories. We were together the other night for dinner. Shay made us like this feast, and we were sharing some old stories of being sick overseas. And Shay, the next year, beat mine. I was like, okay, you're the winner. So, anyway. I think out of embarrassment and out of just the horrific feeling, I think, yeah. So, there was a point we were in Chiang Mai, which is like the upcountry in Thailand, in the middle of nowhere, and you're taking like trucks into these crazy places that you can't get to, pushing vehicles up dirt roads. There was a point that I'm like, I would, poor college student, I'm like, I'd pay $100 for pizza right now. No questions asked. Like $100. I don't even care what's on it. Just something that's not the more Thai food. So anyway, so welcome back. All that to say. So let's continue kind of our Proverbs series on conflict. So I gave you guys a preview last week that we'll recover, and then we're going to end up in chapter 19 today. And then we will return to our story of Nadab and Abihu, our two eldest sons of Aaron. We left them dead in chapter 10, if you guys remember, on Friday. So we'll resume that story as well. So with that, let me pray for us. We'll dive back into the text, and we'll go from there. Lord, thanks for the rain as we wake up to just the reminder that you take care of us in so many ways, God, as you water our land. Thank you for God that God knows our needs, knows what conditions we're in. Father, just pray that you continue to replenish this land specifically as we are still in the midst of a drought and are grateful for your constant provision, God, and it's your daily provision in our lives that we need. So, Lord, as we look at conflict, as we look at interpersonal relationships in Proverbs and how to resolve those and how to go about those in a way that honors you, hopefully would you be honored with us as we seek to elevate our relationships with other human beings in a way that would be more Christ-like, that would help us to grow, help others to grow. And Father, as we look at your Old Testament, as we look at dietary laws and clothing laws and all these laws that seem irrelevant and, God, if I'm honest, weird, Father, would you teach us from them in the midst of the book of Leviticus? Teach us what it is to walk with you and to know you, God. So thanks for today. Thanks for these people. Thanks for their sacrifice. We are grateful to be here. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
All right, so we talked about Proverbs 18 and 19 last week. It was kind of our prequel to the idea of conflict. We talked about a brother offended, if you remember, in 18:19, is harder to be won than a strong city. The idea being, man, when we enter into relationships with people and there's conflict, immediately walls are erected, and to break down those walls takes a lot longer to take them down than it does to put them up. It's like the opposite of construction, right? Demolition's fun. It's easy, and any knucklehead can do it. Erecting walls correctly is a little bit more difficult. It's the opposite here. Man, taking down walls is really, really hard once you have forced another to put those up from your tone, your mannerisms, whatever it was that caused them such great offense. That's just something to keep in reminder. So if we can avoid that altogether, right, and not have to go down that path of reconciliation, boy, that's great. But there are times where you're going to find yourself in difficult situations where reconciliation is mandatory. Okay, so see also Proverbs 19:11. That's just a nugget as we kind of move through here. Okay, somebody read that. 19:11.
Good sense makes one slow to anger, and it is his glory to overlook.
1911. Such a good number, Sean. Don't you agree? A man's discretion makes him slow to anger. What does that mean? What is discretion?
Like his, how do you explain that? Is it like his preference, like in handling the situation?
Yeah, it's kind of how you handle a situation. It's the idea of being able to evaluate a situation and look at it, kind of not emotionally detached, but not being driven by emotion and saying, I'm going to evaluate this. Is this, I'm going to be level-headed about moving through this. Do I need to respond? Do I need to not? It's the ability to kind of take a step outside yourself, look at the situation you're in and say, Mike, here's how you should proceed. That's discretion. It's wisdom, if you will. It's the ability, I think, biblically to judge something or to make a decision about it. So it's, you're almost, detached is the wrong word, but you get the idea. You're not driven by the spur of the moment emotion in the midst of a situation, okay? And it's his glory to overlook a transgression. So in this situation, it's the person being transgressed against, the victim maybe would be the word that we would use, that is saying, you know what? Am I going to respond tit for tat on that? Just because somebody volleyed one over to me, am I going to return that volley? Or can I just say, you know what? I'm going to let that go, okay? It's the ability like a duck, right? You say like the water comes off a duck's back. There's a great expression that we have that's fleeting right now. But that's kind of the idea. It's being thick-skinned. When do I need to enter in? So maybe somebody says something that's a jab, and maybe it goes past, and maybe they sincerely didn't mean to offend me. And I can choose to say, man, I really take offense to that, or I can go, you know what? I can give them the benefit of the doubt. I can move on. It's not that big a deal, okay? There are situations like that, and I think sometimes as people with different personalities, we need to learn how to be a little bit more thick-skinned and let stuff go. And you got to decide, is this something that I'm going to enter in on? Do I need to now retort in a healthy, godly way to have this conversation? Or do I need to say, you know what? Honestly, I trust them. I know them. It's not a big deal, right? I've got a fairly gruff personality at times, right? And friends that have been around me for seasons give me a lot of rope, right? They know that's Mike. He has off days, right? And not to excuse behavior, but they'll say, ah, he may have said something that I know he didn't mean, and that doesn't make it okay, but they are godly enough to go, man, I'm not going to take offense to that because I know Mike, he didn't mean it that way. And then there's times where they say, no, Mike, I'm actually going to take offense to that, and we need to have a conversation about that because it's not appropriate, or whatever it may be, right? So this is the idea of, when do you hit that line? At what point do you say, okay, no, we actually need to have a conversation. This affected me or whatever, and it's now requiring not just me being silent, but me entering into this conversation, okay? So let me give you four, maybe benchmarks, if you will, signposts of when to not overlook a transgression. When is it appropriate to say, you know what, we need to have a conversation, we need to sit down, we need to be intentional about this because of whatever's happened, okay? Number one, okay, here's when you do not overlook a transgression. If whatever happened dishonors God, okay? You're in a relationship with someone and there is clearly something that's happened in the way something was said and a decision that was made. If there is clear sin involved, the violation of God's word, and you know God is dishonored by this thing and this sin is left unconfessed or festering between you and another individual or between them and God, you need to enter in, okay? So if there are clear biblical mandates that require something like that to happen, then you need to enter in, okay? So this would be one of those things where, I mean, you know, based on the action, the word that was said, whatever it may have been, that there is clear sin involved, then you need to enter in, okay? We could give you a gazillion examples. You know, if I use some incredibly inappropriate language, as I was speaking to one of you in anger, you would go, whoa, Mike, yeah, that's actually not okay. God's dishonored in that. What you just communicated is not appropriate speech. We need to talk about that, right? So I need to confess to the Lord, then I would need to confess to you as well, okay? Secondly, if it has damaged your relationship, okay? There may be times when an interaction has not hit the point where maybe sin directly is involved, but the tension in the relationship is so strong that you know, man, I am erecting walls in my life. I am intentionally avoiding that person. I'm not letting them in. I'm not hanging out with them. When they invite me over for dinner, I'm washing my hair. whatever it may be, but there is now relationship tension that I can't get over. And it may be from misunderstandings. There may not be clear sin involved, but you know, like, look, why is Alex not talking to me anymore? Like, he's mad at me for something. If Alex knows that I've offended him in some way, then it's his job to come to me and say, hey, Mike, man, you said this the other day, and man, it stung. And I trust that you didn't mean that, but boy, it hurt. And here's how it affected me. And it's my job to say, wow, I am sorry. I blew that. I didn't mean to do that. Or, wow, I did, and it was a sinful moment, and I need to confess that. So if your relationship is off, and you realize, man, this isn't one of those things that I can just blow off and let the water come off my back, right? You've got to enter in, okay? And that sometimes takes some difficult processing. And honestly, it's easier at times just to say, you know what? It's going to take time. It's going to take effort. It's going to take emotion. It's going to take a lot of these things, a lot of energy that I don't want to have to expand. So I'm just going to leave it alone and kind of put the proverbial pee underneath the mattress and just let it go, okay? Oftentimes entering in is much more difficult, but it's much more beneficial, okay? Thirdly, I would say if it's hurting other people, okay, if somebody's actions are doing something that's causing harm to those around them, it may not be harming themselves, but it may be harming others, then you've got to enter in. This is cases of, man, I can get angry driving home and flip somebody off. You know, that may not cause harm to me, but that may do genuine damage to other people around me. Words that I say, sarcasm, whatever it may be, right? Where it may not be directly damaging to me, but there is shrapnel everywhere around me that people are having to take on because of my decisions. That's a good indicator that, man, someone needs to step into my life and say, hey, Mike, that's not appropriate. That's not okay. Here's what that's doing. Somebody needs to step in, okay? And then lastly, I would say this. If it's hurting the offender or hurting their relationship with God, man, if I choose to binge drink, right, and nobody's affected by it, none of you are affected, but it's hurting me personally, and I'm not willing to admit that, or it's hurting my relationship with God because of decisions that I'm making, then someone says, hey, Mike, I love you enough to know, and though this isn't directly affecting me, it's hurting you, it's hurting your body, it's hurting, this isn't healthy for you, and it's hurting your relationship with the Lord. Man, this isn't okay. So those are some, maybe four boundary markers to know, like, this is when I need to step in. Okay, so as you guys are evaluating interpersonal relationships, parents, friends, siblings, life group leaders, people in ministry, co-workers, these are some good, maybe just questions to ask. I mean, are any of these things present? And if so, what's the best way to enter in? Okay, and the goal we'll talk about as we move through this is always with an eye towards restoration. Man, how do I restore this brother or sister in Christ to full potential? Even if they're not a believer, how do I restore our relationship? How do I make things as right as possible moving forward, okay? So there's a couple notes for you guys as we're processing this, okay? So we'll talk again more tomorrow, Monday, and Tuesday about all of this and kind of when to enter in and how to enter in and that sort of thing, okay? Questions on that before we move back into Leviticus? Oh, that was a stretch, ain't it? Dude, that was a
No, I changed it. I didn't raise my
hand. I blew you off because I thought it was like...
It just
stretch hand raise.
It's not a question, but a comment is like, I think harmonizers overestimate their ability to look past an offense. And I definitely do that. Like, I'll be like, oh, I can look past that. But then, like, I'll sit back and think about it later.
Yeah.
And so I think it was important that you said that, like, if it's hurting y'all's relationship, like, definitely fix it. So.
Yeah. And that's as a non-harmonizer, that's a great observation. Literally, I mean, I have a little, but very little. My guess would be harmonizers are too easily offended. Like, that's probably the unfair, guess is the wrong word, the unfair assumption I would make on harmonizers. Like, oh, you're too thin-skinned. But I think the reality is, man, because of the value of the relationship, you'll do anything not to enter into conflict, which is going to cause further conflict in the relationship, so I'll just avoid it. So as such, you just bury and bury and bury, and the relationship's jacked. It sounds noble, but man, that's a great way to look at it. So it's good.
Yeah. Thank you.
What about if you offend somebody,
I've been offended, and even though after I approached them, they apologized, reconciled, but in my heart, I know me personally, and I just seen it from other people from talking to them. It's hard to still go back into trusting that person even more. It's just kind of like you're still, but you still avoid that person as if like the reconcile was fake.
There's a difference between restoring the relationship and restoring trust that was broken because of sin. Okay? That takes time to restore. And that's the tough thing about this stuff. I mean, you can ruin years worth of trust that is built in a moment. And that takes sometimes days, weeks, months, years to restore. If I go out tomorrow and have an affair on my wife and then say, hey, I'm really sorry and genuinely sorry, do you think she's going to trust me the next time that I'm out of town on a business trip? Do you think there's going to not be some type of like doubt? No, inappropriately so. She should. I mean, she would naturally go, and this has happened before. And we've ministered to couples that have been through that. And literally that exact same scenario and walk through that tension with them. So that takes time to restore. Okay. So know that. That's part of the process. That all doesn't get healed in a moment. Nor can the offender expect to say, I've asked for forgiveness, you should forgive me. And I've seen in that exact scenario with an affair, the guy that had the affair ask his wife, look, you should forgive me and move on. We should be fine. And she's like, boy, no, it doesn't actually work that way. I want to, and we can grow towards that, but that doesn't happen like that.
Yeah.
So that's a tough part about some of our decisions we make.
There's constantly, I would say, like, of where it's like, just personally, like, I don't even give that person a chance to kind of restore my trust.
Yeah.
It's kind of like we're no longer friends. We're just associates, people.
Yeah.
Like, hi, bye.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just wondering, like, am I really, did I really truly forgive that person? Did I really truly... Like, you know, even it's been years that things change, like, you know. And it's just like a question, like, you know, sometimes I'll question myself about that.
I think you're asking the right question. That's powerful. Because I think in the end, that may be exactly the case. Like, if you haven't truly restored a relationship, that doesn't mean that your relationship will be the same as it was. But it does mean there needs to be true forgiveness there. But I think it's a powerful question for you to continue to ask.
Well, I had another question after Aaron made a comment, but the steps that you gave, where's like the biblical reference that this is applicable? Like, this happens, and then this is what you do.
Like chapter and verse for each one of them?
Yeah.
These are more practical. I don't know that I got a chapter and verse for each one of these. We'll walk through how a little bit more biblically. Biblically, like, hopefully this isn't unbiblical. But this is just Mike's thoughts, whatever. I hope they're not that, Lord willing. But I think as we get into the how, we'll talk a little bit more strategy and that sort of thing.
And then the other comment for Aaron was, in relationships when it's damaged, it's actually healthy in restoring the relationship to understand that the grounds that were broken, new ground that's needed to be established. So in the reconciliation of when you're working through whatever conversation that you're having, recognize that assuming to go back to the way it was, even though we're at where we're at now, is unhealthy. And so in the reconciliation, like, you know, let's say I go keep your car right now, or, you know, cheated on you or something, like, reestablish the new ground that, okay, recognize I was unhealthy. I need to get help. It's not you having to fix me,
right?
Kind of thing. And so, yeah, new grounds have to be set.
That's
in the relationship.
That's very well said. Absolutely.
I feel like this is hard to do when you need to confront like people that are older than you or in authority, like parents. And so I was wondering if you had any experience with that, because I don't know like where the line is, like between like respecting your elders, but also like. So I feel like confrontation to them is showing love, obviously.
Yeah.
So I just,
that's super hard. Super hard. Peer relationships a little bit easier. Authority figures are tough.
Yeah.
I mean, I walked through a pretty difficult conflict situation that involved me. This summer, And Obwald was a part of kind of advising and counseling me and the other party as to how to do that. And as we looked at the situation, there were things that I looked at and said, man, that is on this individual. And I was, as I was evaluating, there was very little that was in my side. Right or wrong, that's how I saw it. The other individual saw it the exact opposite, right? Here's a lot of stuff that's in Mike's camp, but not anything on my side. And Obwald's counsel to both of us was, man, if you're only 2% wrong, then you lead with your 2%. You take the log out of your own eye first in front of the other person. If you ever expect them to soften and say, wow, man, you're owning that, that's pretty godly of you. Maybe there's stuff on my side that I need to. Now, part of reconciliation is I can only own what I can own. So if I want to reconcile, but you don't, I can only do my part. So then I kind of leave it where Paul says, I'm going to be as best I can to be at peace with all men. But with parents, I mean, I think you come humbly. You don't overlook sin per se, but you want to be careful about, is this one of those conversations that I really need to enter into? And if it is, what's the best way to do that? Are there other people that need to do that that speak into them better? If it involves us, that's one thing. If it involves them and there's a life group leader or, I don't know, an authority figure or whatever that can step in, sometimes that's better. But you're right. Those are not easy. Conflict is very, very difficult and exhausting to do well. That's why one of the reasons I have a ton of respect for Obel, because he does it. He enters in. And guys, you... And he's a harmonizer.
Yeah.
And it's a guy that... Yeah, and that's what makes him great, literally. I mean, he's so, he's a good dude. So, but this needs to be a value biblically for all believers. I came from a church in Dallas that was insanely committed to conflict resolution biblically. There were elders at people's houses at 10:30 at night walking through reconciliation. I mean, it was not just on paper. It was, this is practically what that looks like to shepherd the flock of God that God has given us. And it was amazing to hear some of the stories. So it's hard, and it takes time.
I feel like my problem with conflict, just personally, is that after like a certain amount of time goes by, I feel awkward like bringing stuff up, and I'm like, oh, that was so long ago. Like, I feel like we're over it.
Yeah.
And then like I never say anything for so long, and then I'm like, if I bring this up, it was like so long ago, and we've had so much time. We've hung out so many times together, and I've never brought it up, so they're going to be like, this is from nowhere.
Yeah.
And so then I just like, tap out.
Absolutely. That's good. And you're right. That is unfair. So you've got to evaluate that. One of the things I learned when I was at Watermark, the church in Dallas, that we've had a lot of our conflict resolution stuff from. If somebody comes to me and says, hey, Mike, here's this beef, the best response I can give them, and I know it's one of these issues, you need to enter in and say, Katie, give me a timeline. How long before you're going to go have this conversation? When's it appropriate? When are you going to see them? And you say, no. When are you going to have that conversation? Okay, 24 hours, 48 hours max. Okay, in 48 hours, I'm going to call you, and I'm going to follow up on that, and I'm going to make sure you've had that conversation. And if you haven't, I'm going to call so-and-so, and I'm going to let them know that you have something to communicate to them because I value your relationship, and I want that restored. So I'm going to help bring about reconciliation. So, when it gets stale like that, it does get funky because then it feels like you're brown bagging. You remember that thing you did like 8 months ago that, you know, I just let fester under the... So... That's when you've got to do honest business with yourself and say, can I get past this or can I not? That happens to me, by the way, when I'm mowing the lawn. I find myself having fake arguments with people, literally in my head, that I've set up and that I've won. And I go, what is wrong with me? Like, why am I somehow arguing in my head with...
Now I know how people talk to themselves.
Literally. And as literally happens when I'm mowing the yard, right? And I'm like...
Every day.
I guess I'm actually mad at them. And I haven't reconciled, or there's something underneath the surface that I thought wasn't there that's there. And that's dysfunctional. Yeah. So if that's the case for you, you've got to identify that and say, okay, I need to move forward, or I need to blow it off. So
I think that's part of the unhealthy, in a way, friendship I have with my best friend. Because we've been best friends for so long. we'll fight, and literally 2 minutes later, we'll be cool. Like, nothing happened. Yeah, like, we'll be like, all right, let's go back to playing Call of Duty.
There you go.
You trash anyways. And that's it. End of story.
All right, let's get back to Leviticus, shall we? So, we got plenty of good conflict resolution work to do. So, all right. So, we looked at, last week, we started on Thursday. If you were to start outlining Leviticus for me, give me a bit of what you've seen.
The sins, the wages of sins.
Okay. What's that?
A lot of festivals.
Where did we see the beginning? Let's start in, what did we do the first day we're in Leviticus together? What did we walk through?
Examine each sacrificial thing.
Okay. Sacrifices, offerings, okay. Where was the text, chapter 1 through, say 7. Good, 7, okay, yes, very good, okay. Then we felt the shift in chapter 8. It began to move towards this, hey, we're going to launch this thing that we've been building now. The tabernacle's constructed, it's done. We're going to have a ribbon cutting ceremony. And we're in the middle of that, right? 8 and 9 were all about, hey, Aaron, go take a bath, get your sons, they need to go take a bath. Dump some oil on your head. Let's get anointed. Hey, in fact, while we're doing that, let's anoint the whole tabernacle. Let's make it clean. Okay, let's talk to the people. They're going to get kind of ready and prepared. So we're kind of in the section of 8 through 10 is where we're at right now, where we're launching the priesthood for the very first time. Okay, so if I were charting it, that's kind of how I would do it. Okay, but I'm just me. So chapter 10, okay, we saw kind of the actual happenings of this. 8 and 9 were instructions and preparation, all the stuff that needed to be done, the offerings that needed to be made. And then in 10:1, we saw Nadab and Abihu, the eldest sons of Aaron, for the first time now offer sacrifices to the Lord. Okay? And we find out in 10:1 that they offer what is called strange fire. We have no idea what that is, okay? Per se. And we found out in 2 that it was strange enough that God said, I'm going to take your lives. Okay? So we'll talk about the possibilities of what maybe that could be. Okay? So we've got two dead sons in the tabernacle. Aaron's in there with them with Moses. They're in the courtyard, the outer portion where the altar is, potentially. And now in 3, this is Moses' response to Aaron, literally as his two sons are lying dead in the tabernacle. Okay, I've got a different translation for sanctified in 3. What do you guys have?
Holy.
Holy is what the Lord spoke. By those who came near to me, I will be treated as holy. What does that mean? What does the word holy mean?
Set apart.
Useful. Different than common. So what's God saying in response to what just happened? How did Nadab and Abihu not treat God? I am holy, and you did not treat me that way. I am set apart. I am different than these mere relationships. I am different in character, in nature, than you guys, and you will treat me as such. That word holy, hint, hint, is used 31 times in the book of Leviticus. 130-something times in the Old Testament. It's used more in the book of Leviticus than any other book in your Old Testament. Okay? Chapter 19, 2, God says to the people of Israel, be holy because I am holy. And you're going to mimic me. You're going to look like me. So you're going to be set apart, right? You're going to look different because I'm different. And you're going to treat me different because of my nature and my character. So something's happened with Nadab and Abihu where God felt an offense so grievous that they didn't treat him this way that he took their lives. 31 in Leviticus, and 130 some odd times in the entire Old Testament. Sorry, I can't remember that. I can see it on my screen, but anyway, right click, search. That's all I got. So, anyway, I can tell you tomorrow if you really want to know. Hold on. 31 in Leviticus, a lot, more than 100. How about that? More than 100. In the Old Testament, okay? Most importantly, it's used more in Leviticus than any other book in your Old Testament, okay? So, this idea of holy, but Aaron therefore kept silent. That's an odd response. Your two sons just died. Moses kind of pops Aaron a little bit. Hey, you will treat God as holy. And what's Aaron's response?
Silence.
Nothing. He holds his peace, right? He says nothing. Why would you guess that would be the case?
There's nothing to say. It's like no excuse.
What's he saying then to Moses?
I agree.
I watched what just happened. I was a part of this, and I have no pushback. My sons did indeed treat God as unholy, as not set apart, as common, as reckless. I can do whatever I want. Now, there have been a ton of suggestions as to what these kids did to earn this, okay? And it could be one of these. It could be numerous. Obviously, we just rolled through Exodus, and God gave all these instructions. Chapter 30, verse 34 and following, and Exodus talks about the offering, specifically the ingredient list, right? Remember the God's chocolate chip cookie recipe? And he says, this is mine. So when you offer aloe and myrrh and frankincense, this is the proportions of each that you will give. This is the offering that will be offered in the tabernacle. No other. And you may not offer this outside the tabernacle, and you can't modify my recipe. So if you want more cilantro in your salsa, I don't care. This is how you're going to make it, okay? God literally gives them an ingredient list. It's possible that they jacked that up. It's possible that they offered it the wrong time. When were the sacrificial offerings to be made? 9 and say 3. 3, okay, good, okay. The idea is at twilight, 3 o'clock, or the evening sacrifice and the morning sacrifice daily. Maybe they offered it the wrong time, okay? Maybe they took coals from a different altar, from the altar into the altar of incense inside, and somehow messed that up, okay? Some have even suggested that maybe they wanted to take a peek into the Holy of Holies. Maybe they wanted to see the ark and those things, okay? Why would that be a violation? They're not allowed to. Okay, who gets to go in there?
High priest
Aaron.
Once a year.
Okay, it's called the Day of Atonement. We're going to read about it this morning. Chapter 16 of Leviticus talks about that whole idea. So we don't know what it was. I think the text actually gives us a pretty strong hint, which is actually more disconcerting than all of these, right? You think, really? Like, man, they just put a little too much frankincense in the mixture and God killed them? Or, boy, they got the wrong kind of Kingsford and got, you know, match lights or the regular, and like, really, God took their life because of that? Like, what the heck? So, but let's keep reading. Okay, did you have a thought?
Is it like, do you think it was just that they made a mistake, or do you think it was that like their part in it was like careless?
Yes. Let's keep reading and let's ask that question again in like 7 verses, okay? Because I think it's a good one, okay? Verse 4, Moses called also to Mishnah and Elzaphan, the sons of Aaron, sons of Aaron's uncle, and said, come forward, carry your relatives away from the tent of the sanctuary, from the front of the sanctuary to outside the camp. Hey, y'all go in, Aaron's uncle's sons, take the dead bodies, remove them from the sanctuary. They came forward, carried out in verse 5, with them still in their tunics outside the camp, as Moses said. Verse 6, then Moses said to Aaron and his sons, Eleazar and Itamar, do not uncover your heads nor tear your clothes. Aaron's got 4 sons, Nadab and Abihu. They just died. Eleazar and Itamar are number 3 and number 4. And now Moses is speaking to them and says, do not uncover your heads nor tear your clothes. What was a tearing of a wardrobe a sign of? Mourning. You may not mourn right now. Your brothers just died in your presence, Aaron, your sons, Eleazar and Itamar, your 2 older siblings, Nadab and Abihu, they're dead. You may not mourn. Wow, like we can't even be sad, okay? So that you may not die, that he may not become wrathful against all the congregation, but your kinsmen, the whole house of Israel, shall bewail the burning which the Lord has brought about tonight. They can cry, they can mourn, but you can't. Why not? What's God saying to them?
Because they died for
a legitimate reason.
How do people go in there and pull them out when they die too?
They're Levites, so they can go into the outer court, so that's okay. So they're assuming that they're outside of the Holy of Holies at this point, if they ever went in there. We don't know. What else is going on here? Think about this. why do these guys have to come off the bench, the third and fourth string sons, and immediately go in? They haven't warmed up, man, they're in. What God says, you can't take the time to mourn, lest God may become wrathful against all the congregation. What does that mean? You're sacrificing. What are your jobs as priests?
Is to take up the responsibility for others.
What is their primary job? They take God and they take people, and what do?
Reconcile.
They reconcile them, which means what? They're making them livable together. What have Nadab and Abihu failed to do? They didn't finish the job. So how does God currently see the people of God? Unclean. Out of fellowship with him, unreconciled. So he says, y'all, get off the bench, finish what they started. You need to make this right. This is a big deal. Do you see how God's not just saying, hey, they tried, no big deal, it was the first time. Okay, you fouled that one off. We'll get the next one right. He says, you're dead. This is a big deal. You will treat me as holy because this group of people is sin stained and I cannot have fellowship with them in that state. We have to fix that. We have to atone for their sins. Okay? So he says, no mourning. Y'all can cry later. Not now. The congregation can cry. Okay? So, verse 7, you shall not even go out from the doorway of the tent of meeting, or you will die, Eleazar and Itamar. You don't get to leave. You don't get to go to the ceremony. You don't get to go to the funeral. Nothing. Okay? For the Lord's anointing oil is on you, meaning you're in the midst of your priestly service right now. You don't get to leave. This is far more important than your brother's funeral. Okay? So they did according to the word of Moses. Now, then, verse 8, the Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, Katie, read this in verse 9. In the midst of this chapter, this really strange commandment comes in where God specifically speaks to Moses and says, oh, by the way, tell the priests this.
Drink no wine or strong drink, you or your sons with you, when you go into the tent of meeting, lest you die. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations.
Huh. Does that seem a little out of place to you?
Yes.
God, in the midst of this story, says, hey, by the way, priests, when you're operating, when you're doing your job, okay, when you're on, okay, think of a priest like a fireman, okay, you work three, you're off four. When you're off four, great. When you're on, no strong drink, wine, neither you nor your sons with you when you come into the tent of meeting. Why would God be telling them this now? Yes.
Nailed it.
Why? Why did God maybe take these two guys' lives?
Oh, were they drunk?
They walk into the tabernacle that's just been built on inauguration day. They're offering sacrifices on behalf of the people to reconcile them with God, and they're hammered. And God says, whoa! You cannot treat me that way. Wait, I am holy. You're dead. No, maybe. Mike's thoughts on this. Okay? It seems strange that God would offer this rebuke to Aaron and to Moses and the sons had that not been the case. I mean, liken this to you roll in the church, you're coming to the 5 o'clock service, whatever pastor is teaching, I don't want to throw any of them under the bus, walk into the pulpit, and you're like, whoa, bro, did you just finish dinner? Or did you just not have dinner and just had a bottle of wine for dinner? Like, you're tipsy, you're hammered. Hey, open up the Word of God, you know, like, can you imagine the irreverence and the, like, the heart to say, yeah, you know what, I'm a Levite, I'm such a big deal, I'm above the law, y'all peons, I'm going to intercede on your behalf. Like, that's the literally attitude that came with that. And I think God said, no way, you're dead. So if you ask me, I lean this direction. I think these guys were doing the work of the ministry intoxicated.
Hey, so I was going to say, was Aaron aware of this? Because it seems like he wasn't at first. aware of, you know, that his sons were, you know.
I think that's why it says he kept silent. I think he sees whatever's happening, whether it's this or one of the other issues we may have mentioned, that causes this. He says, you know what?
So was he more shocked, like, that his sons did that?
I think so. He's not drunk, it doesn't appear, or he wouldn't be continuing to minister. His two younger sons aren't drunk, or they wouldn't have been invited off the bench. But these guys did something so grievous that it took their lives. So, now, we see examples where God is really, really strong with the first sin and then kind of backs off that. So it may not have required something so big, but this sure seems fitting if you walked into a pulpit hammered to go minister, that God would say, yeah, you know what? We're actually not going to have that. So,
what's the text translation of strange fire?
Unauthorized fire, strange, that's what it is. It's like,
blue.
Yeah, what is it? We don't know. It's a mystery. So it has something to do with the fire pans that they were taking in from the altar with fire on it into the altar of incense. That's where they literally would have their fire pans. And some have said, maybe they used their own shovel and didn't use the one that was provided. I mean, it's all kinds of speculation. We don't know. So the text is odd. But it's in that action that they were doing. So either they were doing the I dotting the T crossing wrong, or they were in a state physically that God was like,
I think most of us can say that those of us who have been inebriated, sometimes we don't dot our I's and cross our T's properly.
Yes.
So
this
yes.
is functioning up all these.
I'm just saying, just throwing that out. Thanks for giving us the full picture.
Hey, these are two seminary students, by the way. Okay.
Praise team.
This is Eleazar and Itamar right here.
Thanks, Mike.
Functioning alcohol.
Hey, so
fair enough. Oh, man.
Where do we get from the text that they were drunk? Because it just says the Lord was telling them, like,
yeah.
not to drink.
You were spilling your coffee when I was talking about this. So. we don't. Kyle! Do you guys need to have a conversation? Like, did that offend you to the point where do you need to reconcile? Okay, cool.
Yeah,
you spill my coffee, I'm going to be pretty upset.
All my Bible, though.
I spilled it on
you. You know what? I got Bibles. Coffee stains my Bible as well. We don't know for sure, Aaron. It's conjecture. It's based on this rebuke that's offered by God. Okay. Now, this sounds completely dysfunctional. This is one of my favorite texts in the Old Testament, and here's why. Okay, let's keep moving through. And you're going to see an aspect of God that I think we fail to see in the Old Testament, or we stereotype the God of the Old Testament in a certain way and go, this is how God is in the Old Testament, and this is how God is in the New Testament. What is the Old Testament picture of God that we say, this is how God is? Wrathful, fireball thrower, right? Sodom and Gomorrah, fireballs from heaven. That's kind of what stereotypically, maybe even sometimes in the circle, but sometimes outside the circle, people say that. And then the God of the New Testament is what? Lovey-dovey, cuddly, you know, fluffy baby unicorn, no law, all grace.
No, I
said I'm saying that I was...
What?
I didn't hear any of that. Tiana was laughing, so we're going to hear some streak right here.
Here's an interesting observation. Like in John 3:16, arguably the most often quoted Bible verse, right? God loves you, he gave his son, and so on. But if you like trail that on down to the end of chapter 3, it says, for those who haven't believed, the wrath of God remains on them.
Yeah.
And like we miss that completely because we're so
we highlight what we want to highlight, right? And say, well, that's God. And in the Old Testament, it's the same way. I mean, Exodus 34, God gave you that autobiographical speech of himself and said, what? I mean, I'm a super merciful God. I do all this stuff. I extend kindness to the third and fourth with thousands of generations. And yet, I will by no means leave the guilty unpunished. But what we fail to do sometimes is weigh those out. This text, I think, gives us a beautiful picture of, listen, you sin and there are consequences, especially when you're the JV priest. Like, this is a big deal. So they need to own that. Now, moving forward, again, this is the part that I love. So, verse 10, you see this. Your job, priest, is to make a distinction between the holy and the profane. The unclean and the clean. By the way, those words, unclean and clean, you're going to hear ad nauseum in the book of Leviticus. Because you guys want to know this stuff. Where is it? Come on. The words clean and unclean occur over 100 times in chapters 11 through 15 of Leviticus. Do you think that's important? Unclean and clean. What does unclean and clean mean, by the way?
Sanctified.
Sanctified. Why, what can you do when you're clean? You can worship. You can be in the presence of God. What can you do when you're unclean? Not. Okay. And unclean, by the way, doesn't necessarily mean sin. Unclean can mean a lot of things. It can mean sin, but it can also mean, hey, ladies. Sorry, it's in the text. You're on your period. You're unclean right now. You can't go to church. Hey, mom, you just had childbirth. You're unclean. Hey, you have leprosy. You're unclean. Hey, Mike, you were in your house and your grandma died and you touched her and you touched a dead body. You're unclean. You cannot worship. Okay, so all the things that God calls unclean, there's someone here that, again, a non-co-ed setting would be awesome, but we're not. And God talks about all these things that make you unclean.
When did it become spiritual? Because this is all like literally clean, unclean. I mean, like, did they ever like begin to classify it?
This was spiritual, though. This is a spiritual matter for God.
That's the idea. And the priest is saying, you're having to discern between that. What's clean and unclean? And you're having to evaluate that, right? So it all is connected to the spiritual. There is no division. It's, yeah, your daily life affects your spiritual life. And your walk with
God.
It's
like a modern thought, because I can't imagine someone being like, no. Church for 2 weeks.
We'll talk about that.
What chapters did you say?
11 through 15.
Over 100 times, right?
100 times. Over 100 times. Okay? So their job is to make a distinction between the clean and unclean. 11. And to teach your sons of Israel the statutes which the Lord has spoken to them through Moses. Your job is to teach the word of God and discern between the clean and unclean. So this is kind of a big job description. So y'all quit screwing it up. Now, 12 and following, we're going to pick up. We got two dead sons have just been dragged out of the tabernacle. And Moses is saying, hey, we're not done. We don't quit for the day just because two people died. Jordan, pick up in verse 12.
Then please. Moses spoke to Aaron, surviving sons, Eleazar and Ithamar. Take the grain offering that is left over from the Lord's offerings by fire and eat it unleavened beside the altar.
All right, so these two sons that just got pulled off the bench, now we're going to finish the grain offering. Okay, so you guys remember the grain offering? We discussed this last week. This was the mixture of like, not meat, but whatever else that they would offer to God. So hey, finish this. Okay, you shall eat it moreover. In a holy place, meaning in the tabernacle, because it is your due and your son's due out of the Lord's offerings by fire, for thus I commanded. Meaning, this is how you all eat. So finish eating, okay? Keep going in 14.
But the breast that is waved and the thigh that is contributed, you shall eat in a clean place, you and your sons and your daughters with you. For they are given as your due and your son's due from the sacrifices of the peace offerings of the people of Israel.
All right, in 14, do you guys remember studying a wave offering in chapters 1 through 7? Haven't seen this. What is a wave offering? Okay. A wave offering is what the priest, yeah, it's what you do at football games, right? It's what the priest would do after someone had offered a bull or a ram, the peace offering, a sin offering. They would get to eat a portion of the offering, right? And they would literally, like, wave it to God as if to say, this is our due. This is what you have provided for us. Based on the offering of this offerer, we now have a portion, and we are going to enjoy what you provided for us. Okay? There was oftentimes a heart of thanksgiving with that. You were grateful, whatever it may be. So he says specifically on 14, the wave of the offering you may eat, peace offering. It's going to go on to talk about a sin offering. And on and on. 15 talks about the thigh and the portions they're going to eat, okay, and all this stuff. So Moses says, hey, go back in. Y'all finish the job. Eat the grain offering. Eat the peace offering and the sin offering that we're going to see, your portion, okay? Now in 16, watch what happens.
But Moses searched carefully for the goat of the sin offering, and behold, it had been burned up.
Now, what were they supposed to do with the portion of the goat of the sin offering?
Eat
it. And what happened? Moses walks in and is like, guys, where's the portion that we're supposed to eat? It's gone. Now, you're Aaron. Your two sons just offered inappropriate sacrifices to God, and God killed them. You're like, okay. Eleazar, Ithamar, you're in. Aaron gives them instructions. Go in, finish the grain offering, eat a portion of the sin offering. Okay? That's your job. What do? They screw it up. They've been given one thing. You had one thing to do. You seen those memes? One thing. And they screw it up. If you're Aaron, what are you thinking right now? I'm about to go to another funeral. My other two sons are about to die. Okay? We're going to find out this wasn't an accident. Aaron did this purposefully. He purposely violated the law of God.
Aaron.
Man,
Aaron's so
evil. Aaron.
Don't look at me.
Don't look at me. Aaron violated the sin offering. Okay? Moses searched carefully. It's gone. Verse 17, Moses is like, what the heck? Why did you not eat the sin offering at the holy place? For it is most holy. He, God, gave it to you to bear away the guilt of the congregation and to make atonement before the Lord. Verse 18, behold, since its blood has not been brought inside into the sanctuary, you should certainly have eaten it in the sanctuary just as I suggested to you, commanded. Just as I told you to do, Aaron, but you blew it. Now, this is a beautiful response. I love this. Okay, do not miss this in the midst of the story. Verse 19.
Aaron spoke to Moses, behold, this very day they presented their sin offering and their burnt offering before the Lord. When things like this happened to me, if I had eaten a sin offering today, would it have been good in the sight of the Lord? When Moses heard that, it seemed good in his sight.
But when Aaron spoke to Moses, behold, this very day they presented their sin offering and their burnt offering before the Lord. Who's they? Nadab and Abihu, the first two sons. Okay? They presented this offering to the Lord. Okay? When things like these happen to me, what is Aaron speaking of?
His sons
that just died. He's saying they were in the midst of offering to God. Moses, I held my peace. God took them and killed them. I said nothing because I'm in agreement with what happened. As grieved as I am in my heart, that's right. So when things like this happen, if I had eaten a sin offering, would it have been good in the sight of God? How am I supposed to take the sin offering? What's the status of my heart supposed to be, Joe? Yeah. At peace, at rest, thankful. Where's Aaron right now? Emotionally.
Distraught.
He's wrecked. Two of his sons just died. And he's saying, had I followed the letter of the law to the T and done what was required, had I checked my boxes, would God be happy right now? No. And what does Moses say? It seemed good to him. So are we saying that God is more concerned about the heart of the worshiper than them checking boxes and obeying the law? Who obeyed, by the way, the letter of the law? Did everything correct in this story?
No.
Nadab and Abihu, apparently. But they were drunk. But did they do everything right? Were they functional alcoholics? Yes. I would say yes. They did everything according to the law. How were their hearts? Jack, God kills him. How did Aaron do? Did he obey the law? No. Like, bold face, I'm not going to do it. How is his heart? Contrite, honest, authentic. And God goes, yes. That's what I'm looking for in a worshiper. I want someone that's honest and authentic and real. I don't care if you check all the boxes. That's not what's important. But what are all these box-checking things supposed to do? They're supposed to change your heart. They're supposed to take you through a process where you go, I'm a sinner. I need reconciliation to God. I need a priest to make me right before the Lord. I need atonement. So all these pictures are supposed to show them something bigger of a God that is willing to lay down the life of another on their behalf so that they can have fellowship with God. These two kids didn't get it. Aaron gets it. There's no punishment for him, and there's no punishment for his sons, even though they are in clear violation of the word of God. We're talking like 3, 4, 5 minutes after these two first sons just died. It's a beautiful story of these two juxtaposed people, right? Doing everything right with a bad heart, God says, uh-uh. Doing everything wrong with the right heart, God says, I'll take that, not everything wrong, but you know what I mean. Not finishing the job, not checking all the boxes when your heart wasn't in a condition to do it. It's akin to the person that, I'll never forget this, right? I was at Watermark, at our old church, and we were handing out communion, right? And the pastor's up front, and he's walking through the communion story and what it means and the blood of Christ. I mean, like this really, really powerful moment during the midst of worship. And there's this gal there. I was on staff, and we were actually handing out the cups that we sometimes do here, but usually go up front. We did that there as well, but it was one of those different services where we physically are handing everything out, and it takes like 15 minutes to do it all. And you can tell this gal is completely like, whatever, right? I handed her the tray. She takes the drink, goes like this, puts it back in, and takes it down. I mean, like, she was taking a shot, literally, and hands it on to the next person. I can tell, man, your heart is completely in the wrong place, right? And then there's the people that are sitting there. They're reverent. They're right. And they get the communion tray, and they just pass it. And you're like, why aren't you taking communion, right? Why would you not be doing that? And I thought, man, maybe there's something going on in their heart where they realize, I'm out of fellowship with God right now. Maybe I'm out of fellowship with another person. And God says, hey, you need to leave your gift at the altar and go reconcile with your brother before you come in here and try to reconcile with me. That doesn't work. Get out of here. Go make things right. Then come to me. And I thought in that moment as I saw those pictures, I thought, man, that's how the Lord is. Is God more honored in this person that doesn't take communion? And then that is a person that does and just checks all the boxes? Absolutely. This, friends, is the God of the Old Testament.
Yeah.
And it's the God of the New Testament as well, who never changes. So remember that. And I think in this crazy, weird story, we see a gracious God who's not trying to get his children to check boxes. He's trying to get them to see these pictures that are supposed to lead to heart change. And what's so unfortunate about the nation of Israel is it's so much easier, and you and I know this, to check boxes, to fake it on the outside, to carry your Bible, to take communion, to show up to life groups, everything's fine, right? And I struggle with that too. It's so much harder to be authentic and to walk with God and to struggle with sin and just be who we are. And this is, I think, in the midst of this kind of crazy, weird story, the lesson that we're supposed to take away from Nadab and Abihu, okay?
Yeah.
So thoughts on that before we move on?
It's got hot in here.
All right, so remember that. I think God is so gracious to give these pictures of him and what he's really all about. And remember, the whole congregation is watching this go down. They're watching Aaron, and they're thinking, dude, is he going to die? Or his son's going to die? So they're learning this lesson from their spiritual leader, right? From the high priest that goes, you know what? That's not the heart of God. So you talk about discipleship, you think the people are beginning or should understand what God's heart is in this. It's amazing, okay? Now, we're going to shift again, okay? So just see if you can feel this. Chapter 11. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, verse 2, speak to the sons of Israel. These are the creatures that you may eat from, and all the animals of the earth. Whatever divides a hoof, thus making it split hooves and chooses to cut, among those animals you may eat, like, are you giving me a menu right now? Like, yes, I actually am. So chapter 11, you feel this really dramatic shift where God is now giving them dietary laws. Here's the stuff, Jews, that you can eat. Here's the stuff, Jews, that you can't eat. Okay? So here's all the stuff on the menu. Okay? All kinds of different stuff. Verse 3, you get what divides a hoof. Like, this is how they're going to determine it. Look at the feet of the animal. Like a cow has a divided hoof. You can eat that. One that chews the cud, I mean, you can eat that, a cow, right? That's good. But if it doesn't divide the hoof or whatever, you can't eat those. And then they go into like these crazy details of what you can and cannot eat. Okay, we're not going to belabor all of this, but God gives Israel a dietary code as to what is clean and what is unclean. And if you eat an unclean animal, guess what happens to you? You're unclean. You don't die, thankfully, but you're unclean, right? So you want to go eat catfish? God says, uh-uh. You can eat that in Texas, but you can't eat that in Israel, right? It's good, but you can't eat it, right? You want to eat bacon? Uh-uh. Okay? Though it divides the hoof, a pig divides the hoof, it doesn't chew the cud, so you can't eat it. I mean, literally, that's the text. Verse 7, and the pig, though it divides the hoof, thus making it a split hoof, it does not chew the cud, it is unclean to you. Like, really? Are we talking about that? Like, this is important enough to God to give them distinctions between, okay, now we have all the dividing hooves animals, okay? These are clean. Uh-uh, no. These sections that don't divide the hoof, they don't do this, you can't eat them. Like, oh, okay. Like, but that's how God is handing these out, okay? So chapter 11 is all about dietary laws.
Maybe you'll get to this, but I find it interesting on two levels. One is, we know that they're not supposed to eat pig because pig is such a dangerous meat to eat if it's not properly cooked, and they wouldn't have known that.
Yep.
And therefore, he says, don't eat something with a cleft hoof because, I mean, it's the same thing.
Right.
So, like, don't eat pig and don't eat something with a cleft hoof is the same thing. It's just giving context.
Right.
And what's additionally interesting is, like, in the Middle East, that's considered a delicacy to eat the hoof outside of Israel.
Right. Interesting.
My boss, when we were deployed, he had to go and enjoy one of those meals. And I was like, thank you, sir, for
yeah.
that bullet. But he had to like go enjoy that's and like funny. Eat like
yeah.
hoof.
That was the thing.
Or something. I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Wait, is there meat in the hoof?
I don't know.
Yeah, just meat everywhere. Anywhere there's
it's
muscle,
like
there's meat.
Soft
right?
fingernails, kind of what I picture.
Right? Well, here's what's fascinating. So one of the reasons that God gives them this law is to keep them healthy, right? So yeah, don't eat bottom-dwelling fish. Like, they can be nasty, right? If you don't cook those right, that's nasty. Don't eat a vulture. They're nasty birds, right? Like, I went and killed a deer and took all the good stuff out, and there's like a pile of stuff that you don't want to eat, colon and whatever. You know what bird eats those? Vultures. They don't care. They eat it all, right? There's like one part of the animal that they won't touch, but man, all the stuff that you're like, they eat it. They eat the stomach. They eat the liver. They eat all of it. So God says, hey, those are filthy animals, okay? Yeah, I made them, but don't eat them. So part of it is truly dietary for your safety. What's the other reason God would say, I know everyone else does this, but you're not gonna?
They're set apart.
You're going to be set apart. You are going to be holy. Okay? Because I'm holy. You're going to look and act different than the nations around you. And all the nations do this, but just because they do it, you're going to look different, right? Sound familiar? That's the society we live in. Yeah, just because that's okay, it's not sin. That doesn't necessarily mean as Christians we should do it or that we shouldn't do it. We've got to evaluate that. God gives them law. Okay, so those are the things, okay? So you see all these different categories. We go into 1 through 8 is all about like four-footed animals, okay? 9 through 12 is all about fish and sharks and that kind of stuff, or all kinds of animals. 13 through 19 is birds, what you can and can't eat. They even go into insects, verse 20 through 23, there were insects that were clean and there were insects that were unclean, okay? By the way, what did John the Baptist survive on?
Grasshoppers.
Locusts, which are? Clean. You can eat those. Okay? Grasshoppers? I don't remember. But locusts are clean. Okay? So, anyway. All right? By the way, verse 24. You will be made unclean if you touch the carcasses, okay, of an unclean animal. You'll be unclean until evening. So, you touch a carcass of a dead animal.
What verse is that?
24.
So, that's like Samson, what he did, right?
Exactly. So, Samson reached his hand into a dead lion. It would have made him unclean. And he should have been aware of that. And then there was a process that you went through to become clean. And it wasn't just wait it out or fake it or whatever, okay? So that's the idea. So 11 chapter, the whole chapter is really about this process of what is clean and what is unclean, okay? Verse 44, chapter 11. Here's a summary of this chapter, okay? For I, the Lord your God, I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, be holy as I am holy. And you shall not make yourselves unclean with any of the swarming things that swarm in the earth. So this is kind of a finishing of locusts and stuff like that. Verse 45, I am the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, your God. Thus you shall be holy, for I am holy. Do you hear the point that God is drilling into the people's heads? Good, okay? Sometimes in books of the Bible, when we study them, we would call those themes. This is the law regarding the animal, the bird, right? God goes into all these, okay? That's the food theme. You're going to eat some and not others, okay? So, 11, it's all about food. Eat this, don't eat that. Here are the consequences thereof. Chapter 12, okay? Childbirth, okay? Speak to the sons of Israel. Verse 2, when a woman gives birth to a male child, she shall be unclean for 7 days. As in the days of her menstruation, she'll be unclean. So a woman is on her period or has a child, a male child, she is unclean for a week. Now, In verse 4, verse 3, on the eighth day the child shall be circumcised. Verse 4, then she shall remain in the blood of her purification for 33 days, meaning she's unclean for a week, and then an additional 33 days she's unclean, okay, for a total of 40 days. That's 7 plus 33, you're unclean, okay?
That sounds really complicated.
We can look at this a variety of days. Why would God make menstruating women or women that had just had childbirth unclean?
Blood is dangerous.
Blood can be dangerous. Do you want people with blood-borne illnesses around other people? No, you separate them. You don't have them worship other folks. You're in your home, and it doesn't mean you can't be. You're not a leper. You're not thrown outside of camp, but you're unclean. Okay, so it's a health issue, right? This is the World Health Organization saying, hey, this is good practice to stay healthy. Okay.
That doesn't make any sense to me because, like, God is the one who, like, causes that. Like, if we don't choose that for ourselves.
Exactly.
So if we're basically being punished for the women back then, we're, like, punished for something that they didn't even, like, it wasn't their fault.
Yeah, and again, get out of your mind, sin, not sin. Okay, it's clean, unclean. Okay, there are things that God actually commands that we do that make us unclean.
So what is the blood of purification now?
That would have been the blood of whatever animal was sacrificed on their behalf to purify them. Okay, so she's going to remain in her unclean state until she's been made clean by a sacrifice of another. Okay, you guys want to get really mad? Okay, yeah, random feminist in here. Watch this. How long is if you're a woman and you had childbirth and you had a male child? How long are you unclean for?
40
days. Okay, if she bears verse 5 a female child, she shall be unclean for
2 weeks.
2 weeks. As in the menstruation, and she shall remain in her purification for 66 days. Okay? Why is a male child, are you less unpure than when you have a female child, or unpure longer?
Because the women sin first.
Because men are better than women. I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. Okay? I'm teasing. Literally, I don't know. But that's what God said. Okay? I don't think God is making a statement about... General, relax. I don't think God is making a statement about men or women. Okay? But for one reason or another, that's how God lays it out.
Isn't it just, I think I read it in like Fifth Romans, but boys rule, girls drool.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe they're better, so they have to be purified longer. I literally have no idea. So as a guy with 3 daughters, I'm like, that's kind of weird. So anyway, but that's the idea. Okay?
Yeah,
here's the can I just opened.
Here's a whole bunch of questions.
Be nice.
Now, with this unclean state, what would be like the punishment or unpunishment? Like they're unclean. They're not able to talk to anybody.
No.
They're not able to...
Your fellowship with your family or with other folks. If somebody touches you, they can become unclean. Okay, mm-hmm. You're not going to the tabernacle to offer sacrifices, so you're not in fellowship in the sense of being able to participate in the daily or weekly ritual that is part of the community. Okay, so you're kind of on, you're on bed rest or whatever.
So being unclean, you can now eat bacon because it's unclean.
Anyway. Technically, yeah. I guess if you want to look at it that way. If you want to pull a Romans 6:1 and say, yeah, there you go.
So aren't you also saying that the sign of like menstruation and stuff was like a reminder of the original sin from the Garden of Eden?
It could be. I mean, there's, yeah. And honestly, some people have connected to that why a woman is unclean longer. Maybe because Eve is the one that ate first. I don't know. I don't think that's the case. I don't know why God. You guys can ask God when he gets to heaven. Why is this the case? Okay? Take it up with God. I don't know.
I think it's like clear that God's heart in this isn't it's clear it's not about sin to me, but. Is this one of the things that, maybe not the Pharisees specifically, but took them, twisted and, did they, abuse what, I don't,
They abused all the law. Jacked it up, twisted it. Yeah, I don't know that we see specific instances of this one, but, yeah, there's certainly, they jacked the whole law. So,
Mike.
Yep.
If you take this, say you're going through the book of Leviticus with the church, mm-hmm. How would you connect this? What does this symbolic mean? Because I know, a lot of these laws and everything, I can already see it, kind of foreshadowing Jesus. But where does this one comes into kind of play? Is it just kind of, here's a bonus?
No, I think it literally is the idea of you're a holy people. You're set apart. you're to look and act to be different. Mm-hmm. Does it all make sense to you? No. Is some of this for your own good? Yeah. There's a reason that you don't eat bottom-dwelling, filthy fish.
So it's more of God looking out for his people. So it's like to us, it's like, Mom, I can't get that candy. What? Are you kidding me? But it's Mom looking out for us, so we'll get cabbage.
Eat your vegetables. Don't eat so much candy. I don't like broccoli. I don't care if you like broccoli. It's good for you, and a diet of M&M's or not. So I don't really care as a parent. Eat it.
Makes sense.
So that's part of it. Some of the law is that way, for sure. The dietary law, for sure. Did they all get this? And it's like, you think they liked the bacon? I like bacon. Of course, right? And Peter, thank God, saw a vision from God with bacon descending upon the sheep. And thank you. God gave us bacon in the form of pigs, and that's why we get to eat it. So that's why. Okay? Chapter 13, okay? Leprosy. The entire chapter is about, look at this, till 59, almost 60 verses on leprosy, okay? Hansen's disease is what this is what we would call this. So if you have a communicable disease, if you have, you guys know what leprosy is, by the way?
Yeah.
Skin disease.
It's one of the most fascinating diseases in the Old Testament, and it's fascinating that they talk about it so much. It is a disease, literally, that causes you to lose your extremities. The tips of your fingers, ears, nose will literally almost like rot away.
Yeah.
And the first thing that happens is you begin to lose feeling in all those areas. And it starts in toes, fingers, nose, ears, eyelids, right? You lose sensitivity, okay? Now, it's not just a physical disease. It's also kind of a spiritual disease. It has a picture, okay? There's a king in the Old Testament, those studies, by the name of Uzziah, okay? This guy is a punk king. He starts really good. He finishes bad. He has a hard heart. And God strikes him with leprosy. He's in the temple. He's in the tabernacle. He's in the temple at his time period. And he's offering sacrifices to God as a king from the line of Judah. Okay, we are in the midst of Leviticus. You get why that's a no-no, right? And he basically says, I'll do whatever the H I want to because I'm the king, so I can go offer sacrifices. And God says, strikes the guy with leprosy. And it's a beautiful picture of, man, you are losing sensitivity to me. It's not just a physical disease. It's also a spiritual disease. You have lost touch with me, right? So 13 is all about what happens when you get leprosy. Okay, lepers get kicked outside of the camp. They are unclean. They have to walk through this long process with the priest to say, are you healed? Are you not healed? Okay, you can come back in. But what's the idea behind this? Why would you take someone who has a communicable disease and throw them outside the camp? Same reason we save people the flu. Stay home. Throw up on your own. Don't throw up at work. Throw up at home. We don't want to throw up either. So, yeah, Jordan.
Oh, I was going to ask what we know about the disease. Is it, if it's just something that spreads, how do they get it?
I don't know.
Patient zero.
Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea where it originated from. So, anyway. So, it's not just, by the way, leprosy. It's any skin-borne illness. By the way, chickenpox would have fit into this chapter. If you have, like, look at this. Verse 4, if the bright spot is white on the skin of your body, like if you were like, wake up and you're like, oh, I got a rash. Nadab, what is this? He'd go, oh, buddy, that's got pussy stuff on it. You're out, okay? And I don't know if it's leprosy. I don't know if it's chickenpox. I don't know if you just got, like, ringworm or... maybe you're just allergic to grass, okay? And it's just going to be here today, gone tomorrow. I got kicked outside of the camp, and I would have to go evaluate that with the priest, and he'd have to look at it and go, yeah, you're good. You're fine. Or, hey, Mike, it's getting worse. Not only do you have one here, but now your face is broken out, right? Or you got shingles or whatever it may be. So all those, like, skin-borne, pussy, oozy, nasty illnesses would fit into the context of chapter 13. And it was the priest's job to discern between the clean and the unclean. Okay, so that was their job. So anything of that nature would fit in there. Yeah, Derek.
You said that story that you was talking about having the king Uzziah.
Mm-hmm.
Is he related to Aaron now?
No, he's Judah, Aaron's Levi.
It's super easy in these couple chapters to think that God is like punishing people in a way because of uncleanness or cleanliness. But you mentioned that God commands us to do things that would make us unclean. What can you explain that?
Yes. Turn to chapter 14.
Oh, yes.
Chapter 14, sorry, is the cleansing of leprosy, okay? We're going to see this picture in another chapter. I'll show it to you later. But once you're redeemed, okay, by the priest, you had to go through a process. We'll talk about it later. Skip chapter 14, okay?
Yeah.
15. I'm going to show you what I was going to tell you. I thought it was 14. It's 15. Sorry, I misspoke. Okay? How about this? 15 verse 18. If a man lies with a woman, sorry, so that there is a seminal emission. What do we call that? It's called sex. Okay? Okay? This is in a marriage context. If I lie with my wife, if I have sex with my wife, they shall both bathe in water and be unclean until evening. So you're telling me that when I do what God has commanded me to do with my bride in an appropriate relationship, this isn't outside the context of marriage, this is marriage, that I am now unclean? Yes. Why? It's all about emissions, okay? It's all about fluids, okay? So fluids make people unclean, okay? Childbirth, semen, okay? All of it. So yeah, my, is this a right thing? Yes. Am I in sin with God when I have sex with my wife?
No.
No. But am I unclean? Yes. Did God tell me to do that? Absolutely, right? So that's part of what I get to enjoy with my bride. It's wonderful, but it makes me unclean. So when Mike's not at church, you're like, did you touch a dead body? Or I'm not telling you. Look, yeah, you know what? I did. I touched a dead body. My bad. I ate some bacon today, and it was so good. So, okay, so that's the idea. So we have to get outside of our head, clean and unclean. Part of this is for the protection of Israel. They need to understand and why God is so vivid and graphic on this. I'm not even going to read chapter 15 to you guys because it makes me feel uncomfortable. Some of the stuff that's in here about all the fluids that are mentioned and
you got to read it.
No, you guys can read chapter 15 on your own and ask me questions tomorrow, okay? But we'll read some of it, okay? I just got to remember the parts that we're not supposed to read, okay?
You can read it to, like, your family for family time.
I've told you that story about Madison reading Genesis 30.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that awkward, okay? This is actually a step worse than that, I think, actually, okay? Anyway, you get the idea in these chapters that any bodily discharges make you unclean, whether it's blood, whether it's pus, whether it's semen, whatever it is, okay? And that uncleanliness can be transferred, okay? verse 8, if the man with the discharge spits on the one who is clean, he too shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. So if I'm unclean and I spit on Sean while I'm teaching, Sean's unclean, right? Because that is a discharge of fluid.
So it's okay? Like passing on cooties.
Basically, okay? Yeah, there you go. Verse 9, every saddle on which the person with the discharge rides becomes unclean. We saw this with Rachel and her dad Laban, right? When she was hiding underneath the idols. Okay, go ahead. So your saddle that you sit on, if you're unclean, becomes unclean. So just the transference of unclean to other things, okay? All kinds of processes by which you would go through to make yourself clean. Verse, by the way, 19 through 24 is women's menstruation. That makes a woman unclean. 16 through 18, by the way, you can read on your own. That's the part I'm not going to read. You guys can figure that one out, okay, now that you've completely quit listening to me, and I'm going to read other stuff. So 25 and following is like irregular discharges. The bed that you lie on becomes unclean if you're sick and you've got some like unknown whatever that makes you unclean. It's bizarre. Okay, so just this is all about that. Okay, so you're getting a feel for chapters 11 through 15, food, childbirth, leprosy, eat this, don't eat that, all kinds of different clean versus unclean issues. And now in verse 16 or chapter 16, we enter a whole new area of scripture. Okay, so we're going to stop talking about these clean unclean things that, again, we've seen over 100 times those two words mentioned, and it's going to talk about now the Day of Atonement. Okay, so what I want to do is set up the Day of Atonement for you a little bit, talk about kind of the process, and then 16 we'll actually get into it tomorrow. Okay, so we'll finish this, but I want to set it up. Okay, you guys remember in your Exodus chart, and I think even Shay gave it to you in the Acts material, the feasts and festivals of Israel, right? In the spring, we start with Passover, go to unleavened bread and first fruits. Those are the three spring feasts. March, April, right? They all revolve around the harvest. Then, like, sandwiched in the middle of the spring and the fall feast is Pentecost, right? You guys saw that in Acts chapter 2. That's when all those people came to the Lord. Yeah, two. And then in the fall, we have these three feasts. Okay, these are all in your Exodus chart, by the way, but I just want to point them out. Okay? In the month of Tishri, which is September, October. I always wish we were studying this book during that time so we could like correlate them, but it's always, I'm always too slow. We have these three feasts, okay? Rosh Hashanah, okay, which is the Feast of Trumpets. We have then Yom Kippur, Yom Kippur. Yom is the same word that's used in Genesis for the day, okay? So it literally means Day of Atonement. You guys remember I talked about the Ark and the Mercy Seat? The covering is called the Kafar, the Kippur, whatever it is. That's the same word, okay? So literally it means the Day of Atonement or the Day of Covering, okay? And then lastly we have Sukkot, okay, which is tabernacles or tents. That's the celebration of God took us out of Egypt. We lived in tents in the wilderness for 40 years. We're not there yet, but we're about to go through that. And then the Israelites would celebrate this event every year as a remembrance. Okay. So what I want to do is talk about these feasts and what's going on kind of in the midst of these and go from there. Okay. So real quick, I want you to skip 16.
Mike, do we have all these feasts in ancient Israel or do we not get these until like the temple?
No, they're in here. Like, look, turn to chapter 23. God literally sets these up. Okay. chapter 23, Leviticus. By the way, these are in Exodus as well, but they're more specific even here, okay? Chapter 23, verse 1, you get laws concerning the Sabbath, okay? So, hey, every Saturday, Jews, you're going to stop and give a day to me. That's kind of the sabbatical law, or Sabbath law, I should say. Verses 4 through 8 of chapter 23, the whole chapter, by the way, is the religious feast. It's the whole breakdown of all the seven feasts that they go through. Chapter 4 is Passover and unleavened bread. We started with that in Exodus. Verse 9 and following, you see first fruits. Okay, and then finally in verse 15 and following, you get Pentecost. We see the three spring feasts, then Pentecost, which is sandwiched in the middle. And then in chapter, let's see, where do we go? 23, okay, we get trumpets, okay, which is Rosh Hashanah, okay? Aaron says, speak to the sons of Israel in the seventh month, on the first of the month, that is the month of Tishri, so Tishri 1, you're going to blow a trumpet, and you shall have a rest, a reminder by blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation. You shall do no work, and you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord, okay? So here's what I want you guys to think about, as we think about these specific feasts, okay? Passover was like, think about our New Year's, okay? January 1, okay? It represents really two things for us. What is January 1 for us?
New Year.
It's New Year's. It literally represents a new year. We're going to go from 2016 to 2017. It's a new year. It also represents something else for us. What do we do as Americans on New Year's?
New Year resolution.
You make resolutions. You think. You reflect, okay? Take those two concepts and divide them, okay? Passover was New Year, 2016 to 2017. Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur was the spiritual aspect of New Year's. Stop. Reflect. Pause. Think about your year. What's gone on? How are you? What's your relationship with God like? And what's your relationship with man like? Okay, by the way, Rosh Hashanah is on Tishri 1, okay, or the first of Tishri. When is Yom Kippur? 10 days. So this season, some believe, though, it's said specifically here, on this day on Rosh Hashanah, you do no work and whatever. Yom Kippur says the exact same thing, okay? Look at verse 26, okay? 27 of chapter 23. On the 10th day of this month, it shall be a day of atonement. It shall be a holy convocation for you. You shall humble your souls, present an offering by fire to the Lord. Neither you, verse 28, nor any of this, neither shall you do any work on this day, for it is a day of atonement, to make atonement on your behalf before the Lord. Verse 29, if there's any person who will not humble himself on this same day, he shall be cut off from his people. What does that mean? Kicked outside the camp and or die. Okay? Verse 30, for any person who does any work on the same day, that person I will destroy from among his people. Okay? Most of the holy days were like a big, huge not sinful frat party. Celebrate, get together, have a glass of wine, eat some food. That's what Sukkot is. Let's remember God's provision for us, and let's enjoy fellowship with one another with God. Okay? Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur were not that. They were introspective. They were a time for us to think and reflect communally and individually. Okay? Some would suggest that not only do you not do work on Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, but you don't work for 10 days. And you certainly want to don't do anything that's going to make you unclean in that season so as to not be able to participate in Sukkot, which is coming. Okay? So all this is in preparation. So if you think about it like logistically, you're called to stop and to rest. Literally, it says Rosh Hashanah is the Feast of Trumpets. A trumpet would be blown from the top of the tabernacle or the temple as it is later times to signify this is the beginning. And from that point forward, you would do no work. You would do introspective things with your life, okay? These are called in later days. This isn't in our text, in the Bible, but in the Mishnah, the Talmud, and other external sources, the days of awe, okay? Where you would literally take the concept of New Year's and extend it for 10 days and think and process about life. What do I need to do different? What's my sin list look like? Where am I at with God? Are there any relationships that I have that are jacked? I need to go make that right, okay? That's the purpose of this 10-day season.
Wow. It made me think of the woman at the well, how in her culture, a Samaritan woman like that, needed Jews would restrain from her, or them, like anything they touched, they would never touch, and because it was considered unclean. Yeah. Or anything that they would have involved with, they would just stay away from that because they would be considered unclean.
Yep.
But yet Jesus comes and asks her for a drink. Yep. And it's kind of like this reflection of, let me take your uncleanness and cleanse it.
Yeah.
Good. So it's just
okay.
This big picture.
So on the back side, by the way, of this is Sukkot, which is the gigantic celebration. Okay. But in between that, there's this period of awe and introspection. Okay, so as we move into the Day of Atonement tomorrow, I want you to think about the mentality of Jews and where they would be, what they would be thinking about, what their stature and just just how they would be feeling and thinking in this season.
So is Yom Kippur the day that they actually put the blood on the mercy seat?
Yeah. We're going to walk through that in detail tomorrow. Yeah, that whole process and how it works. Okay, it is one of my top three texts to teach in the Bible. I love this chapter because it's so picturesque of stuff that we're supposed to see. And I promise you, there are aspects of Jesus that you're missing if you don't understand Yom Kippur. I promise you.
So are there like a good amount of Jewish holidays that we could definitely like take benefit
to,
like, learn so much from like observing?
Yeah, all of them. We're not commanded to, but can we look at this and say...
Well, we totally could.
Man, instead of getting hammered on New Year's and going to some party and, you know, kissing people under mistletoe or whatever, what if we took a season in our life to do deep introspection? And went, Lord, what do you want from me this year? Where am I out of fellowship with you? Are there things in my life that you're like, Mike, that could be better, right? Are there things that I'm happy, are there Nadab and Abihu attitudes within me that I'm casual about? Or... Lord, what do you want for me in the future? Like, do I take time to do that? I don't reflect. I don't know about some of your personalities. I don't. Like, I am an achiever. I am in go mode. Looking back is useless, okay? It's not. But in my mind, it is, right? I don't reflect. So I commit stupid things continually because I don't think back and go, why did I do that? What was my motive? Why, you know, what's the sin pattern here, Mike, right? That's useless. But Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah were a period where... People were commanded to do that. So, though we don't have to, there's some great lessons that we can learn from that, okay? So, we'll jump into Yom Kippur tomorrow and go from there. So, yeah, Joe.
Is this still done in Israel?
It is, yeah. So, they do this because they don't have the temple, by the way, to sacrifice. The holiday schedule becomes even more important, okay? So, this is still done, okay? Very much so.
Around what time is it?
This is September, October season. Is Tishri. Okay? So this is their New Year's.
Hold on.